Picture this, right? You're driving down a winding, unfamiliar highway, and it's the dead of night.
Oh, that's already stressful.
Right. But you're making good time, you're feeling confident, and then click. Your headlights completely cut out.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that sudden stomach-dropping panic, the way your knuckles just instantly turn white on the steering wheel while you plunge into total darkness. I mean, that is exactly how a lot of us feel when we try to look at our own futures lately.
Yeah, we treat the future like that pitch black road, right? Like it's this terrifying void we're just hurtling toward.
Completely out of our control.
Exactly. And that physical reaction you're describing, it's actually deeply wired into us. I mean, from an evolutionary standpoint, human beings are biologically built to hate a lack of visibility.
Because we want to know what's coming.
Right. Our brains are basically just prediction machines. We actually crave certainty, even if it's like a painful or negative certainty. We
Hard.
crave that far more than we can tolerate the ambiguity of the unknown.
That makes sense, yeah.
Because, historically, an unpredictable environment used to mean there was a predator hiding in the bushes.
But look at how incredibly fast the world is shifting right now.
Yeah.
I mean, economically, technologically, socially, suddenly, driving without headlights is basically just the baseline reality for everyone.
It really is.
And it's taking a massive, measurable toll on people. I was looking at this staggering statistic from the source material for today's deep dive. So, according to a 2022 report from the Prince's Trust, 49% of young people in the UK feel anxious about the future on a daily basis.
Really?
Yeah, every single day. And 59% say the future is actively frightening to their generation.
Which is just a profound level of chronic stress to carry around. I mean, your cortisol levels are just constantly spiking day in and day out.
Which is exactly why the mission of our deep dive today is so crucial. We're looking at this really brilliant empirical study by Kirsten Bonn Sørensen.
Yeah, she's doing some incredible work.
She really is. She's doing something super unique in the field of futures research. She argues that concepts like reframing and imagination, which, we usually just lock those away in art schools or corporate design sprints.
Right, like they're just for designers.
Exactly. But she says they shouldn't just be tools for developing new apps. They are essential everyday life skills that we actually require to combat this exact modern anxiety.
Absolutely.
And the findings we're going to explore today, I'm telling you, they will completely change how you view your own stress.
Well, what makes Sørensen's paper so compelling is the research design itself. Because, this is an empirical study. She didn't just sit in an office and theorize about stress.
Right.
She actually went out into the field to test this on real people who were dealing with immense, like, life-altering uncertainty. So she set up workshops for two highly stressed groups in Denmark.
And the first group was 95 journalism students.
Yes, students who were facing what's culturally known over there as Panic Day.
I mean, just the name Panic Day tells you literally everything you need to know about their mental state.
Seriously.
It's this hyper-competitive day where all the prestigious internships are handed out, and the feeling is if you don't get one, your career just feels over before it even starts.
The pressure on these kids is astronomical.
Yeah.
And then the second group she worked with, this was 12 academic professionals who were facing long-term unemployment.
Okay, so totally different demographic.
Totally different. These are highly educated people, and their entire identities, their livelihoods were just on the line. They had been experiencing severe, protracted stress for a very, very long time.
So she puts both of these groups through workshops designed to fundamentally alter how they interacted with the future. And the results were just astonishing.
But also kind of a complete mystery.
Right. So let's look at the unemployed academics first. When they were forced to use these design tools, specifically when they were forced to vividly confront their absolute worst-case scenarios, they didn't spiral into a deeper depression like you might expect.
No, the opposite happened.
Their anxiety actually decreased. They gained this profound sense of agency. And get this, 50% of them found jobs or subsidized work within just 6 weeks of completing the course.
Which completely upends our conventional wisdom about how stress and anxiety even function. In the paper, Sørensen actually leans heavily on the work of neuropsychologist Wendy Suzuki.
Oh, I've read her stuff.
Yeah. So Suzuki argues that anxiety isn't a disease you just have to, suppress or hide or medicate away. If you can properly reframe it, the physiological arousal of anxiety, so that racing heart, that heightened awareness,
The sweaty palms.
exactly, all of that can actually be transformed into a cognitive superpower. It becomes this positive force that fuels flexible thinking and resilience.
Okay, but hold on, because here's the twist. While the unemployed professionals had this massive breakthrough, the younger journalism students had a wildly different reaction.
Yeah, they really did.
45% of the students actively rebelled against the process. They called the workshop totally irrelevant. One even explicitly called it a complete waste of time and resources.
It's a stark divide, isn't it? I mean, to understand why half the participants unlocked a literal cognitive superpower and the other half just completely rejected it, we have to look really closely at the underlying mechanics of uncertainty itself.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we get into the actual workshop exercises, we need to understand why that dark highway paralyzes us in the first place.
Right.
Like, what is actually happening in our brains when we face the unknown?
Well, in the paper, there's a psychological concept introduced, and it's called the intolerance of uncertainty. Researchers describe this as a transdiagnostic risk factor.
Okay, transdiagnostic meaning it crosses over into different clinical diagnoses. Like, it's not just one specific disorder.
You've got it. It means that a fundamental inability to tolerate the unknown is the psychological bedrock. It's the root mechanism underlying multiple forms of anxiety disorders.
Wow.
From OCD to generalized anxiety.
Yeah.
When you literally cannot tolerate uncertainty, it fuels negative emotions. It biases your expectations, so you only ever see the worst possible outcomes.
You're just wired for doom.
Basically. Mm-hmm. And it creates inflexible responses. You just freeze. So to counter this, UNESCO has actually been pushing this really interesting concept called futures literacy.
Futures literacy. Okay, so like financial literacy or computer literacy, it's a skill you can actually learn.
Exactly. It's a competency.
Mm-hmm.
UNESCO argues that imagining the future is a fundamental human muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the problem is most of us have let that muscle completely atrophy.
We don't even use it.
Right. We've been trained to think of the future as something that simply happens to us, like a fixed destination that we're just being dragged toward against our will.
That actually ties perfectly into this brilliant idea from media theorist Douglas Rushkoff that's mentioned in the text. He points out that we usually treat the future as a noun.
Yeah.
Like it's a place, right? A dark room we're being pushed into. But he says we should be treating the future as a verb. It's something we actively do.
Which is a massive paradigm shift.
But here's my pushback on that. If we're supposed to treat the future as a verb, like something we actively construct and shape, how is that physically possible when our brains are completely frozen by the biological panic of not knowing?
Well,
I mean, you just said our amygdalas are literally screaming at us that there's a tiger in the bushes. How do you verb your way out of that?
And that is the million-dollar question. And it's exactly why Sorensen brought in two specific cognitive frameworks from the design world to unfreeze those brains. She knew she couldn't just tell these highly stressed people to, you know, be less anxious.
Right, that never works. Calm down never works.
Never. She had to give them a tangible cognitive toolbox.
Yeah.
So the first tool in that box is design thinking, and the second tool is futures thinking.
Okay, so how do those actually work in practice? Let's break them down.
Sure. In the source material, there are visual models provided for both of these concepts. So design thinking is often represented by something called the double diamond model.
The double diamond.
Yeah. Imagine two diamond shapes lying side by side. You start at a single point on the far left. That point is your problem. Then the lines diverge. They open up. You open up your mind. You explore the problem. You look at all the underlying needs and insights. And crucially, you do this without judging them.
Okay.
It's the first half of the first diamond. But then the lines converge again. It narrows back down to define a specific, actionable area of focus.
So it expands to gather all the information, and then it contracts to make a decision.
Correct. Then you enter the second diamond. You diverge again to develop multiple potential solutions. You're testing wild ideas, seeing what fits. But ultimately, you have to converge a final time to deliver one concrete tested product or solution.
Got it.
And this relies heavily on reframing. You're questioning the dominant values that are inherent in the problem to try and open up a totally new solution space. You are intentionally changing the lens through which you're looking at the issue.
Okay, and how is futures thinking different from that? Because they sound a bit similar.
Oh, futures thinking operates on a totally different wavelength. It doesn't converge on a single final product at all. Instead, it starts at today's world, right now, and it continuously diverges outward into this massive cone shape.
Oh, interesting. Just constantly expanding.
Yes. You look at weak signals, macroeconomic trends, cultural shifts, and you just keep widening the scope to create multiple highly divergent future worlds. You aren't trying to predict the one exact future.
You're illustrating an array of possibilities to see how you'd react to them.
Exactly.
Man, I love a good visual. So design thinking is almost like using a funnel to bake the perfect cake, right?
Okay, I'm with you.
Like you gather all your diverse ingredients, you mix them all up, but ultimately you're pouring all of it into a specific pan to get one concrete edible result.
Yes, perfect.
Well, futures thinking. I mean, earlier I thought of it like throwing flour into the wind to see what shakes it makes, but that's not quite right.
Not quite, no.
It's more like meteorology, like weather forecasting. You aren't trying to bake a cake at all. You're throwing flour in the air to track the direction of the wind.
Oh, that's a fantastic analogy.
You're mapping where the wind might take things based on current signals. So you're prepared whether a massive storm hits or the sun comes out.
You're mapping the conditions, right? Not forcing a specific outcome.
But wait. If someone is already totally overwhelmed by uncertainty, like if their transdiagnostic risk factor is just going off the charts and they're basically having a panic attack about being unemployed,
yeah.
Doesn't forcing them to imagine multiple divergent futures just make the panic infinitely worse? I mean, you're giving them even more unknowns to worry about.
What's fascinating here is that it actually does the exact opposite.
Really?
Yeah, through a mechanism called cognitive flexibility. Mm-hmm. See, this isn't about predicting the future perfectly so you can finally relax. That's a myth. It's about building the psychological muscle to tolerate ambiguity. It's what the researcher calls life-centered design. When you practice holding multiple possible realities in your mind at the exact same time, without forcing a premature conclusion, you actually train your brain to stop demanding immediate certainty.
You're kind of short-circuiting the panic response.
Literally. You're desensitizing your brain's threat response.
Yeah.
You become mentally flexible.
Okay, so we move from all this theory to the actual human experiments to see how this cognitive flexibility was tested on the ground. Let's look at assignment one that Sorensen gave to these two highly stressed groups.
Right, the scenarios.
Yeah. So the journalism students, who remember are absolutely terrified of panic day, they were asked to map paths from that day to three different scenarios 3 years out.
Right.
Getting the dream gig, feeling disappointed because they got a mediocre placement, and total failing to get an internship at all.
And then the unemployed academics were given a slightly different and honestly arguably much heavier task.
Yeah, much darker.
They were instructed to vividly imagine and visualize remaining permanently unemployed. The absolute worst case scenario. Sorensen asked them to picture themselves in that depressive state of mind, like fully at the end of that dark road with zero hope of a job.
Which just sounds completely counterintuitive. And here's where it gets really interesting. I mean, we live in a society that is absolutely obsessed with like good vibes only, right?
Oh, completely. Toxic positivity everywhere.
Yes. We are constantly told to manifest success, envision the dream job, make a vision board, and relentlessly block out any negativity. But Sorensen actually asked them to look directly into the void.
And face it head on.
Exactly. The educator Parker Palmer actually calls this the tragic gap. It's that painful space between what is and what could be. And looking into that gap was the actual cure for their anxiety.
It was profoundly healing for them. Let me actually share a quote directly from one of the unemployed participants who did this worst case scenario exercise.
Yeah.
So she said, quote, "It seems strange in the first place, but it made good sense to visualize my worst case scenario. It made my worries much more concrete. In this way, it is now easier to face my fear and handle it. It opens the door to working more creatively, both on developing new paths to achieving my dream scenario and new paths if my worst case scenario comes true."
Okay, that actually gives me chills. It made my worries much more concrete. Because when you think about it, it's the amorphous, shapeless nature of the dark highway that's terrifying.
Yes. The ambiguity is what kills you.
Once you turn your brights on, even if you see that the bridge is totally washed out ahead, at least you know exactly what you're dealing with. You can make a plan to detour instead of just white-knuckling it and bracing for a crash.
Exactly. By visualizing the worst case, she dismantled the invisible monster. She identified her specific anxiety triggers, which stopped that biological, physiological panic cycle we talked about.
Right, the cortisol spikes.
Exactly. And that allowed the cognitive, creative part of her brain, her prefrontal cortex, to finally turn back on and start problem solving again.
But dismantling the fear is really only half the battle, right? I mean, knowing the bridge is washed out stops you from crashing, but it doesn't automatically build you a new road.
Right, they still didn't have jobs.
Exactly. Okay. They had a blank slate. Sure, their brains were unfrozen. But they needed a framework to rebuild their self-worth so they could actually go out and get hired. So how did Sorensen get them to do that?
Well, this brings us to the value proposition exercise. This was heavily focused on reframing their core identity. The researcher asked the participants to just stop thinking like passive employees.
Okay.
And start thinking like entrepreneurs.
Okay, think about your own job right now listening to this. If you were laid off tomorrow, how would you describe yourself? I mean, most of us would just say, I'm an unemployed project manager, or I'm a writer looking for work.
And that's exactly what it means to think like an employee. An entrepreneurial mindset shifts the perspective entirely to the end user,
the customer.
Right. Sorensen instructed them to imagine themselves as independent shop owners. Their individual skills, their empathy, their competencies, those were just products displayed in a shop window.
Oh, I love that.
They weren't asking for a job anymore. They were offering a specific value to a market.
And the psychological relief this provided to the Danish academics was massive, because for so many of these professionals, their entire sense of self-worth was just intrinsically tied to being chosen by an employer.
It's devastating.
When you're unemployed for a long time, the degrading internal logic becomes, no employment equals no human value. I am worthless. But when you reframe yourself as a shop owner, you separate your personal identity from your professional identity.
Your self-worth isn't just on the chopping block every single time you send out a resume.
Yeah.
You're just a merchant pointing to a window saying, hey, do you need this product today?
Right. And if the hiring manager says no, it doesn't mean the product is garbage.
Not at all. It just means it wasn't the right fit for that specific buyer on that specific day.
And the real-world outcome of this was just incredible. One participant actually took this exact shop window concept and put it straight onto her LinkedIn profile.
It's brilliant.
She stopped passively waiting for hiring managers to judge her worth. She took immediate empowering action, and she generated a ton of positive attention and job leads.
This really raises an important question about how human beings actually undergo deep structural change. Because if we connect this to the bigger picture, what we're witnessing with these academics is a psychological framework known as Mesereau's four stages of transformational learning.
I really want to slow down here because this is so crucial. This is the constructivist theory of learning, right? Like breaking down how we actually rewire our deepest core beliefs.
Yes.
Let's walk through what it actually feels like to experience these four stages.
Okay, so stage one is what Mesereau calls the disorienting dilemma. This is the locked, painful situation where your current worldview completely fails you.
So the unemployment.
Right. As one participant perfectly described it, it's the sheer passivity of just awaiting a manager's judgment that kills your motivation and slowly eats away at your self-esteem. It is a deep crisis of meaning.
So it's that jarring realization that you've just hit a wall. You played by all the rules. You got the degrees. You did everything right. But the system isn't working for you anymore.
Yes. Which forces you into stage two, which is self-reflective debrief.
Okay.
This is where the learner experiences intense cognitive dissonance. They realize their old models of reality are fundamentally broken.
The belief that I am a successful, highly educated academic, so I should feel secure, violently clashes with the reality of their anxiety and their unemployment checks.
Exactly. Which leads to stage three, identifying strategies for experimenting with a new role.
Ah, this is the shop window.
Yes. They start testing out the identity of the entrepreneur. They dip their toes in the water and they realize, hey, a manager's rejection doesn't actually change my core human value. I survived the rejection. I'm fine.
And finally, stage four.
Stage four is reintegration. The new reframed values become a permanent part of their conscious identity.
So feedback just becomes an opportunity for learning rather than like a devastating attack on who they are as a person.
Precisely. They have fundamentally transformed how they interact with the world.
It's a beautiful success story. But to be intellectually honest here, we can't just cherry pick the happy ending.
No, we really can't.
We have to look at the other half of the empirical data, because the data tells a much messier, far more complicated story. The academics clearly achieve this transformational learning. But what about those 95 journalism students who were facing panic day?
The contrast is honestly jarring. While the academics found this entirely life-altering, about 45% of the journalism students called the approach completely irrelevant to their lives.
Ouch.
Yeah. One student actually submitted feedback saying, and I quote, call it creativity, reframing, a new mindset, or whatever. In my eyes, this is not at all useful in order to prepare for an internship. It's a waste of time and resources.
Oh, man. I know I'm laughing, but that is brutal. I mean, that is a devastating review for a workshop that was entirely designed to help them manage their panic.
It really is.
So why did it fail so spectacularly for almost half of these younger, highly stressed students?
Well, Sorensen doesn't shy away from this failure. She actually analyzes it. She breaks down three primary reasons for this student rebellion. So first, the students fundamentally misunderstood the concept of reframing. They thought it was just toxic positivity. One student literally complained, "Making bad situations seem better is not exactly reinventing the wheel." They completely missed the point. They didn't grasp that reframing is a complex cognitive restructuring of reality, not just, pasting a smiley face over a bad situation.
Let me guess. If they thought reframing was just toxic positivity, they probably viewed this whole design workshop as some fluffy arts and crafts distraction from actually securing a job.
100%.
They completely avoided looking into the tragic gap.
They absolutely did. Which leads to the second reason, which is a profound discomfort with depth. The workshops required examining deeply held personal values and vulnerabilities. For many students, this was uncomfortable. It felt invasive. It was just scary. The academics, on the other hand, had signed up for a course with an individual psychological focus, so they accepted the premise going in. The students just wanted a tactical step-by-step guide to hacking the interview process.
They wanted the funnel, not the flower in the wind.
Exactly. And the third reason, they viewed creativity as an unserious activity.
Unserious.
The source references another study at the same Danish institution, showing that students often view creativity as strictly secondary to the hard metrics of securing an internship. They wanted concrete strategies, bullet point lists, not what they perceived as abstract design exercises involving post-it notes and future cones.
This brings up something so fundamental about how we're raised, especially in highly competitive environments. I mean, it really makes you wonder, are our educational systems training us to be merely reality discoverers who just observe, adapt, and report on the world exactly as it is?
Rather than possibility thinkers.
Exactly. Rather than possibility thinkers who realize they have the actual agency to actively shape and reframe the world.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it highlights a crucial and frankly somewhat painful aspect of Mesereau's transformational learning. The unemployed academics only succeeded because they had been beaten down enough by life.
Right, by the agonizing, disorienting dilemma of long-term unemployment.
They were forced to accept that their old behavioral models were permanently broken. They were desperate enough to try throwing flour in the wind.
But the students, despite their intense panic, hadn't reached that breaking point yet. They still believed the old system, grinding endlessly for the internship, would save them.
They were still clinging to the steering wheel.
So, what does this all mean for you? Whether you're facing a scary career transition, dealing with a massive creative block, or just feeling totally overwhelmed by the generalized anxiety of reading the morning news, these tools are available to you right now.
They really are. Reframing isn't just for white-collar design sprints, and futures thinking isn't just for corporate strategy consultants.
It's a way to turn everyday anxiety triggers into Wendy Suzuki's concept of a cognitive superpower. You don't have to be a passive victim of uncertainty, just waiting for the headlights to magically come back on.
No, you really don't.
You can map your worst-case scenario to make the monster concrete. You can put your skills in a shop window to protect your self-worth from the judgment of others. You can treat the future as a verb.
We spent a lot of time today talking about applying the shop window and futures thinking to your career, your professional identity. But I actually want to leave you with a different application, something built on the paper's concept of inner sustainability. What if you applied this cognitive flexibility to your personal life?
Oh, I like where this is going.
If you treated your closest relationship, so your marriage, your partnership, your family dynamics, what if you treated them not as a fixed noun to be rigidly maintained at all costs, but as a verb with multiple divergent futures? I mean, how would your daily interactions change tomorrow? What if you stopped demanding certainty from the people you love?
That completely flips the script. Instead of gripping the steering wheel, just staring into the dark and praying you don't crash, you're suddenly the one holding a flashlight. And maybe you decide to pull over and just build a completely different road altogether.